hello, Eric. How are you?
Hey, good. How are you doing?
All good. My name is Andrew, and I'm starting this mini series about the possible attacks that the state could do on Bitcoin. But actually, it's about the ways that the state can hinder the adoption of Bitcoin as world money. The series would be on legal attacks, social attacks, and technological attacks. And I'd like to discuss with you the, let's say, legal attacks that the state could do. Money today, as we know, has some properties, but it's actually fiat that we use today. And as we all know, in 1933, the presidential order asked for all the people to bring their gold, that was the thousands of years money, bring the gold to the banks. Do you think that's where the split happened from what real money is and what is today?
No, that's just an event, a long series of events that are similar. Thousands of years, at least hundreds. But it's a good point in time. It's a good example anyway.
And do you think that gold was the correct way of looking at what money is?
Well, it's a good example of money over time. I mean, it's the last, kind of one in predominant use before, states transition to notes to represent the gold and then eventually fiat. So I guess you could say it was the best one that the market had developed as a money to date, or to that point.
Mm-hmm. And the properties that the money has today, I personally think it favors some part of the society, like the political elite, but doesn't serve the rest of the people. Did we get to this type of money accidentally? Was it a natural way of arriving here, or do you think it was on purpose?
I think it's intentional, and I think it's you can be more specific than just favors, wealthy over not wealthy or anything like that. State money is a tax vehicle. It's a very simple idea. It's just another way to tax, either through monetary inflation, where the state can issue itself units of the currency, spend them before price inflation takes away that advantage, or with electronic state money, especially giving the state the ability to monitor transactions, which therefore gives it a significantly greater ability to enforce other taxes. Either tax evasion or money laundering, whatever you want to call it, that's the other avenue of taxation. Enforcing those laws is the other avenue of taxation through the money. Of course, that's much more recent than using money as an inflation tax vehicle. So they're both in effect with state monies today. And it doesn't necessarily have to be fiat. I try to be very specific about my terminology. You can tax money with monetary inflation using coinage, right, which is not fiat. Yeah. Through gold and other metal debasement. You can also tax through notes, which are not fiat. They're promissory notes for the actual money, be it gold or something else. So typically, what we see and what we saw in the U.S. in the example you give is you start with metal, you move to coinage, you move to depositories and promissory notes for the coinage. The advantage there are some technical advantages, some technical deficiencies in that, but the reason that the state does it is because the notes can be decoupled from the backing, right? And that allows to some extent the state to maintain a fractional amount of backing, and that works for some amount of time because not everybody needs their money at all at the same time. But at some point there's not enough left to satisfy the demand to clear accounts. And so we end up in a crisis situation where status, you know, at some point has no option left but to delink or abrogate the notes, right? Delink them from the backing money, in that case, gold or other metals like silver. And now you're at the point of fiat, where the money has no, the notes are no longer in effect. They have no redeemability for anything, any specific money. So then it's fiat. So that transition from notes for money to fiat is interesting, because now the fiat is the money, right? It is not a promise for money. It is the money. So the reason for that is, you know, if I'm sure you understand, but just to be explicit, the reason a state does that is because it can make money by creating more of the notes. That's why we have counterfeiting laws, right? If anybody could make them, they would quickly not be very useful as a money. And we see that in places where you end up carrying truckloads of it around, right? When there's a lot of it, it's not very useful anymore. And the purchasing power, of course, drops as well. But that's – so with commodity money like gold, what makes it useful is it doesn't need laws and anti-counterfeiting laws to maintain its portability, you know, its ability to carry around. It doesn't grow and grow and grow in quantity. Yeah. So it works perfectly well, a market constraint on production. So the difference between the cost of producing fiat or even the notes and the price that they're trading at is an opportunity, right? It's a price higher than production. And in any case where that happens, somebody's making profit that can't be brought down through competition. So there's your seigniorage revenue, which is the privilege of the state because it has the power to enforce those anti-counterfeiting laws. Other institutions can't do that. They don't have the power to enforce those laws. They just start creating the fiat, floated it around. You know, other people would just create it. So that's not true of something like notes. You know, banks had issued bank notes in the past and very successfully. Of course, there's a counterfeiting risk to that, but there's a legal obligation, right? In other words, they're notes, they're contracts, and when somebody fakes one, that's fraud. Where you have fiat, the piece of paper itself represents the value, and there's no promise to anybody. As such, anybody can just go make as much as they want. So fiat tends to be reserved to the state because it has the ability to enforce the monopoly on production. Yeah. Anyway, they do it for taxing reasons. Otherwise, there's really no need to deviate from either using notes, right? Because if you're not going to print more than you have, which in private situations would be a fraud, you know, not being able to redeem them would be at least a business failure. Yeah. And of course, you could just use the actual metal itself as the money that backs the accounts that people have, right? That's the value that the accounts represent. So you could do those things, but the state doesn't do those things because it's a tax opportunity. Mm-hmm. I like to point out there are technical advantages to paper money, whether it's notes or fiat. For example, historically, coin clipping was a problem, right? Shaking bags of gold and taking off the dust, right? Devaluing the market will actually do that. And with paper, you just, you know, return it in for a fresh one, and it's got the same fungibility. So it resolves that problem. And also, clearing accounts with gold, transportation costs are much, much higher. So there are a couple of technical advantages. Some people say, you know, it's easier to carry around paper. I kind of dismiss that one. You know, paper, tiny little piece of metal, not a huge difference. But there's that too.
Yeah. So today we don't use paper that much like we used to do before. And
well, there's an important distinction here that's hard for people to make, that there has to be a money independent of the accounts. Right. So when we say we don't use paper, what we're actually using is loans, right? Either a loan to the bank where you have a deposit account, or a loan from a bank where you have a loan account. Those accounts are not the money. Those accounts are promises, right? So you loan somebody some money, you get a promise to pay it back. So we move around those promises, but eventually the promises have to clear. And the simplest way to imagine them clearing is when you walk into the bank and you say, give me my money, and they hand you the paper or the gold or whatever. So now now that you have the money, but we don't, when we talk about using electronic money, that's a money substitute, and that will exist no matter what type of money you use. Right. So money substitutes existed with gold. I mean, if we didn't have them, if we didn't have the ability to lend and account for that lending, there'd be no production at all. So it's true that people clear their accounts very infrequently. They just move the promises around. And you could certainly imagine having an entire system where that's all there is. We're working towards that. And maybe Sweden, you know, I think announced that they were going to do that. Soon, where just eliminate all the actual money from circulation. And yeah, well, I don't think they use banknotes. I think they use fiat. Banknotes are promises. They're notes. So again, the terminology gets hard because even the U.S. dollar says Federal Reserve note, but that's an anachronism. They used to be notes. Now they're fiat. A note is a loan, right? So you have this. You can imagine you have this system where, you know, right now the vaults hold the money and the banks move it around to clear accounts, right, to settle the money into the places where it's owned. And presently, you know, a lot of the reserves that are supposed to be held, or at least, you know, by law in the U.S., for example, held by individual banks, have been pulled back into the Federal Reserve. Which, if you run the system, it makes a lot of sense, right? The clearing is a process of moving the actual money around. And the more centralized you have the money, clearing becomes a lot cheaper, right? Less trucking and flying and, you know, carrying of big pallets of dollars between banks. You just, you know, metaphorically kind of shuffle it between rooms in the one big vault. So at some point you can imagine you don't even do that anymore, right? You put all the money's now in the reserve, the Federal Reserve, and they just keep track of it electronically, right?
Yeah.
So that's ultimately where we're heading. But it doesn't mean there's not some money, whether it's fiat or another accounting system which maintains the units of the money behind the actual loans that we talk about as money.
Yes, the IMF came out with an article talking about a way of solving future economic collapses, where they want to convert the banknotes or the fiat money to electronic money, you know, to go to head mm-hmm. for a cashless society. So wouldn't you say that's a completely different type of fiat, where you cannot clear anymore your bank account and you cannot make a bank run?
So it's kind of it's interesting. This gets very esoteric. It took me a long time to figure it all out, and I'm sure this will confound people even more. But so when you talk about, you know, what you're using on your credit card or bank account, anything that's account-based, anything that's not actually tangible in our world today, and I'll set aside Bitcoin for the moment, but you know, any money that you think of as tangible is a money. And what you're transferring around on credit cards, bank accounts, checks, wire transfers, those kind of things, those are not monies. Those are accounting for money that somebody owes somebody, right? That's money, technically a money substitute. And if you have a bank account and it says it has, you know, 1,000 euro in it, you've actually loaned the bank 1,000 euro, and you just have a, you know, a registry entry in their ledger that says they owe it back to you. Mm-hmm. You can move that promise around, right? Yeah. But when that promise settles somewhere else, eventually the money has to get moved as well. And that's clearing, right, your account. And so or settling, when people say I settled my accounts, it means they no longer have any debts out or in, right? All the money has been actually settled into the places where it's owed. There's no more obligations. So there has to be a money independent of the accounts, because the nature of lending is that, you know, the accounts are not the money, they're promises. And so you would have, if you have a purely electronic money and a purely electronic system of accounting for that money. You have two different things. And with dollars, we call it dollars, even if it's in your bank, right? It's, but it's not. It's a promise for dollars, just like a Bitcoin is in your that you have the private keys for is not the same as a Bitcoin you have at Coinbase, right? It's a promise. So that's account money. And so they can, those promises can be made to more than one person. Not on the same money, right? Or not on the same credit. It's you know, hard to explain, but it, but that's where you end up with fractionalism, and that's the nature of money, right? I lend it to you, you deposit it with me, you know, it's mine now, but I don't actually, you know, I there's an obligation, and I can lend it back out to somebody else, and I have to maintain some amount of reserve to satisfy those accounts, and eventually all the money gets held in reserve. That's where it all is at all times. It's held in somebody's reserve.
Like you say now, these IOUs that are traded online, they're all backed by the physical money or the money.
Exactly, isn't that?
Yeah, but that people don't. What happens when we get to a cashless society where it's not there's yeah. online IOUs?
Well, there's no money. Well, see, this is where people go wrong because they don't clearly understand how the system works in the simplest form, where you have just say gold, right? If you imagine everything as gold and accounts for gold, right, loans, then you have people making loans so that they can make products, produce things. This is necessary. You end up with everybody who's got some money. Some of it is actually held, and some of it is lent out, and that's called credit expansion, right? The amount of money that people imagine is actually greater. If you have like a 10% reserve for everybody, if everybody reserves at that rate, then you end up with about 9 times as much, you know, money combined, both the account-based money and the reserve. So you have these two concepts, and people think of them as one, and they think just because we go to electronic, they've all become one, and that's not possible, right? If it all becomes one as electronic, then the same thing happens, right? People lend it out, and now it goes into two different types, right? So it would be an infinite regression. The money would be worthless, immediately. Yeah. So that's not what can happen. What could happen, or what would happen with a purely electronic money? You can imagine with Bitcoin, right? Yeah. Bitcoin is an electronic money. It's not a promise to get money. So it's purely electronic. Now, if I lend you some Bitcoin, right, I have a promise to get Bitcoin, and you have the money.
Yes.
So now that promise I could account for as a discounted amount of money, the discount on the risk of not having it, or the risk of not, or the certainty of not having it until some point in time, right? I get interest for that, which compensates me for the time. But, you know, it's not the same thing. But I might still account for that as, oh, yeah, I've got 100 Bitcoin out on a loan, right? Yeah. And if you gave me some, say you call it a deposit, but it's still just a loan, you would say I've got 100 Bitcoin on deposit, right? You think of that as you have 100 Bitcoin, even if it's demand deposit, right? But it's not. So these two concepts have to coexist. If you can imagine like a state electronic money, you can imagine, well, eventually all the money gets collected up in one vault and nobody's actually ever clearing their accounts except the state, right? It's moving it around, in this imaginary, okay, you have it, now you have it, now you have it. And they do a ledger thing just like Bitcoin, for example.
Yeah.
So imagine, you know, not secured like Bitcoin or anything like that, but just a simple accounting system that's secured through traditional computer accounting. And it's keeping track of who actually has the money. That's independent of the banking system where we're keeping track of who actually has an obligation for the money. So that's what you would imagine. Those would be two different things. You would still have to have this concept. At least somebody would still have to have this concept of the money. In that example, it would just be the state, right? So if you swipe a credit card, you know, you write a check, you do a wire transfer, you look at your bank account, you're only dealing with account money. You can't have any – in that example where the state does all of the clearing and holds on to all the accounting for the actual money, individuals would never see it.
Yeah.
But it would still be there. And then inflation, you know, monetary inflation would be just adding some more and giving it to yourself, right? Right, just create, you know, pushing a button. But this is what people imagine is happening today, and that's not what actually happens today. What actually happens today is one of two things in terms of creating more money. You either – you know, it either gets essentially authorized by Congress in the U.S., right? Like we can expand this monetary supply. So the state authorizes itself to go basically print some more money, and they introduce it into the system when somebody wants to borrow it. They borrow for a house. The bank doesn't have the bank doesn't have enough money to issue them the loan. They go borrow some money from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve doesn't have the money. So essentially the state together produce this new money, lend it out, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And the benefit. Yeah, but the
economy.
This lending happens at a discount, right? So nobody actually, the reason they can afford to lend to the banks at a discount and lend to the consumer at a discount is because the money can be printed at almost no cost.
Yeah.
And so that's the source of all the issues that people imagine. It's not banking itself. It's the fact that with the authority to print more of the money, you can lend it out at discount rates and move it into the system, where if you couldn't do that, say it was gold, say we went to the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve was out of gold, you'd be kind of out of luck. You'd have to go dig some more up, right?
Yeah.
So the source of the distortions in the monetary system come from the ability to actually print that dollar and then lend it out. And maybe it never actually gets trucked over to the bank and then to the consumer, right? It all gets cleared through accounting of promises. But that clearing does still happen. I mean, it has to happen, right? This money now belongs here. And that when that loan gets repaid, right, that money actually now is owned by who? It was lent out by the state. Now it comes back to the state. But they lend it out again, right? They never destroy it.
Yeah.
Right? They could, and they'd say sometimes we're going to mop up the money, supply, but they don't really destroy it. Maybe they start printing it less quickly, but in practice that really never happens.
Yeah, that's why all the countries in the world are in debt, right? They have national debts. They all do this.
Well, no, this isn't why they have debts. This is how they pay their debts. And when a country wants to spend money on something like discount housing loans, right?
Yeah.
This is how they do it, right? Yeah. They but what they're doing is actually buying votes, right? So with the power to print money, you're taxing everybody who holds the money, right? Everybody's got money in their accounts now is being taxed because they're the pool of money is increasing, and therefore you'll have monetary inflation, which eventually leads to price inflation. So it may not lead to price inflation immediately because people may just leave that money in their accounts, right? But there's a lot more of it. So when it starts getting used, now the loans start getting made. They're a lot cheaper, and you see prices going up in that money. So I just want to sum up the digital money concept would have to have a concept of a digital money. It may or may not circulate, with consumers and banks, and maybe only held in the one, the central banking authority. But that has to exist independently of what we think of as bank money. But it's also possible that state could create a different unit that, you could have possession of, and it could register it in its registry, and you've got some money, right? But it's a separate concept.
Right.
Okay. I'm rambling on.
Yeah. So what we have today is Bitcoin, right? Which we can both agree it's much better money than what we had until now. At least it's an experiment.
It's better at some things. It's not better at other things, right?
Yeah. But do you think Bitcoin will make the states be more fair with the taxpayers and maybe not make inflation that high? Do you think it will be an attack to them?
I tend to like regress down to first principles whenever I get asked a question, and it's like, well, ultimately, what is a state doing with money? It's taxing,
yeah.
Right? Well, taxing is never fair. So the state's not going to stop taxing, and it's not going to get more fair.
Yeah.
When you talked about, favoring some people over others, that's the purpose of the state,
yeah.
Right? It's to collect money with taxes and spend them in another way than the market would have done by itself. So take the voluntary system of the market and let people vote or have a king or dictator or whatever and decide, well, we're going to take some here and we're going to put it over there. So taxing through the money is just another way to tax. Will states stop taxing? Absolutely not. If they lose power to tax because people aren't using their money, they're still going to tax some other way. So Bitcoin allows, it's more of a way to allow people to opt out from that process, right? They may get taxed in other ways, but they can avoid getting taxed both by the money and by transparency of their transactions by using this money. So whether it compels the state to act in a different way, that's a, you know, it certainly could, but whether that different way is better for anybody or not is hard to say.
Yeah, perfect. That's where I want to get. So let's imagine in the future, for the sake of this interview, that the dollar doesn't exist anymore, right? And we have only bitcoins in the world. The countries could adapt different monetary policies. I know that you vouch for the black market mine. This is where everything will head. But let's imagine that one country would try to back the national currency, like recreate fiat, but backed by Bitcoin, right? Like we had it before, the gold.
You mean analogous to the gold standard? Yeah, exactly. You would have the Bitcoin standard.
Yeah, yeah. We can imagine that a country could do that, you know, because not
absolutely
all of them will just say, no, Bitcoin is illegal. We mm-hmm. could assume that some would try to back the a new national currency with Bitcoin.
Yeah. So the way
we will just repeat the history, you know, it's we'll take.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason to believe that what happened with gold it wouldn't happen with Bitcoin in that scenario. That's one of the many issues with that scenario, right? There's just no reason whatsoever. You know, imagine the state decides they want some Bitcoin. Well, they're going to issue notes in exchange for people's Bitcoin, just like Coinbase issues promises for people's Bitcoin, right? They might just go to Coinbase and take all their Bitcoin and say, you know, who knows? That's been done too. That was done in the U.S. with gold. They just went to some people and took it from them. But they issue them promissory notes, right, which are dollars, gold certificates, you know, at times. So you could imagine these notes are created in order to obtain gold, to obtain Bitcoin. So I call them Bitcoin certificates, right, instead of silver certificates. So the state is securing everybody's Bitcoin for them in exchange for these notes. Okay, and now people are using the paper Bitcoin certificates, and the state is collecting a reserve of Bitcoin. Why does it do this? It wants the Bitcoin, right? That's why it did this with gold. Otherwise, it could just use the gold to use the Bitcoin directly. But these notes are monetary substitutes, right? They are loans, and they create monetary expansion, and so credit expansion, and so. So you still have the same system of lending, credit expansion. You know, if you have a 10% reserve, you know, if everybody has a 10% reserve, you're going to have 9 times the amount of Bitcoin and Bitcoin certificates as you had original Bitcoin. So none of that changes. The one thing that changes is the state can't make more of it, just like it couldn't make more gold, right? But it doesn't stop them from issuing more certificates than they can redeem in gold, and they'd probably be safe up to a certain point in doing that. So the certificates will be reduced in value over time through that, and then eventually they get in debt, which is the source of the problem, not the money. Well, not the money. The money's how they're paying the debt, right? So they get in debt because they overspend, and they no longer can redeem the certificates, and we get 1933, right, or 1971. That wasn't just FDR going, "Oh man, I think I'm going to do this," right? And neither was it Nixon saying, "I just want to do this." This was. We've already done it, and now I can't redeem it, right? When the French showed up at the U.S. and said, "We want," you know, at the Federal Reserve, and they said, "We want our gold. Here's your dollars." They said, they said no, and they I think that the French said, "Well, this is a dollar. It's your problem." And the response was, "You know, it's our dollar, but it's your problem." Right? So that's what you get eventually, right? Is that's one of the many problems that you get with the idea of a Bitcoin-backed note. Is eventually it's going to just be a Bitcoin-backed, and it's going to be an unbacked fiat. And who's left holding, you know, a lot of Bitcoin, right? The state. So there's other problems with that. Right? If people are primarily transacting in account-based money, notes or fiat, eventually, who's actually validating the Bitcoins? Not the people, right? The states, they're in other words, when they go through their clearing process, when I move some Bitcoin from one bank to another, from one country to another, it's only state institutions that are, you know, for the most part, you know, the member banks and the other states that are actually validating the coin, which means that all they have to do is get together and say, hey, let's add an inflation rule, right? And so they do, and they all decide to accept it. And the small number of people that are actually, you know, accepting Bitcoin and see that as invalid money don't matter, yeah, right? They don't have enough economic power to stop that. They just get forked off. So that's I think, inevitably how a Bitcoin state money system would end up.
The thing that I thought about a lot was when we went to fiat money, the properties that it had were decided more or less by the people that held the real money, you know, the gold. So the political elite, the banks, they had the power to decide what money is after they confiscated all the gold. So
can you be more specific? I don't know what you're implying. I mean, it's kind of euphemistic. If you could be more specific, it would be helpful. So
the money, what we considered money for thousands of years, like real money, the properties it had were fixed and they could not be changed. But when the banks could hold all the gold and they could convert it to something new, that's when they could change the properties of what people around considered money.
Well, let's like be clear. The
type of money.
When we had gold, we had banks. When credit, and money have evolved together over time. There's never been a situation in human history with money where we didn't have money credit, right? Because people lend it. So you know, all a bank is a metaphor for a loan, right? Either giving the bank a loan or taking out a loan from the bank. You know, people lend. So the banks didn't get any magic new power from the process of doing that. Credit expansion is natural, and absolutely. I mean, it's a duality. It's not something that, you know, eventually happens because of banks. Whenever there's money, there's lending, and therefore you have, or whenever there's property, there's lending, right? And so you always have credit expansion. You always have credit. You always have accounts that represent the credit, and that happens with gold. It happens with Bitcoin. It happens with fiat. So the power that you're talking about comes from the fact that I can produce money at below the value that it gives to me on the market, right? And that's the benefit of state money, is because they can do that legally, right? It may be criminal, but they're doing it lawfully. So it becomes a tax vehicle. So that's the only distinction that really should be made here. This is not a banking issue. This is a issue of law and monopoly privilege on creation of the money.
Right.
You can't grant yourself that privilege if the money's gold, right? But as soon as people start using your gold certificates, now you can. You can't grant yourself that, you know, permission with Bitcoin, but if they start using your Bitcoin certificates, now you can. And if
change the implementation, right? The states can just collude and change.
Well, it doesn't even require. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, or one state can do it. You know, they can just say, you know, in this state, this is, you know, so they fork themselves off if they're small enough. But so when you say changing the properties of money, I mean, money has properties, right? To be good money, it has properties. It doesn't erode quickly. It doesn't rust too badly, right? It doesn't. It's easily identifiable and verifiable. Gold is yellow, makes for nice money. It's portable, which means, you know, some metals have a lot of good properties for money, but there's the amount you would have to carry around with you would be way too much. I mean, iron used to be used as a money, you know, in some places, but when it became cheaper to produce it, it became not portable. So, okay, not very good money anymore. So there's these properties of money we talk about, you know, portability, divisibility, identifiability, good store, which means it doesn't corrode over time. These things really can't be determined by some, you know, oligarchy or something, right? They can't change those properties. So when you say changing the properties of money, I'm not exactly sure what you intend by that.
Yeah, like we have today, the fiat, but like you said, if we go back to national currency backed by money, by Bitcoin, we just repeat history. So
yeah, and there's a number of arguments that people make to try to claim that can't happen. For example, verifiability or auditing. Right, like with Bitcoin, we can see the ledger, when we can have the state might have to produce proof that it has all of the Bitcoin in reserve that it has given out in promissory notes, right? In negotiable promissory notes. Well, that's not, because people don't care, right? Yeah, people know they're doing it, and they don't stop them. So that's an obvious reply to that thing. We could have said, as voters, we want to audit Fort Knox, where they would keep a lot of the gold, but we didn't do that. But even maybe it's easier with Bitcoin, right? Maybe there's some way we can do it. But people imagine this; they don't actually think through the technology or the forces at work here. Even if the state could certainly create a proof that says which outputs it owns at some point in time, right? And you could then look and see, at this time they owned them all, but they could have sold them a second later, So you could trace that. But the harder problem is knowing how many certificates there are. How do you prove that? Right. We only issued this many, so everybody in the world has to get together at the same time and put all their certificates in a pile, right? Or make promises, and you have to trust them. So you get back to the same auditability problem as you always had, right? Somebody has to trust an auditor. Somebody has to go and find all the stuff. If certificates are in an account somewhere, how do people verify the account, right? Even if it's all in one place, so you have to trust the people that are running the account. So this idea that there's some kind of cryptographic auditability. This doesn't add up at all. You can account for the Bitcoin to some extent, but you can't account for the credit issued against it. Yes. Bitcoin doesn't change that problem.
Only even in a country where they tried to issue national currency based on by backing with Bitcoin.
Yeah, in that situation, it doesn't change anything from gold. It does solve one problem, because Bitcoin's an electronic money. It makes it much cheaper and easier for the state to clear accounts, right?
Yes.
You can just move the Bitcoin around. But if you want to imagine going to an electronic money where you're trusting the state, that can be done without any other money at all, except for an electronic ledger that the state controls, which is essentially all that Bitcoin is, right? So, if you're trusting the state anyway, just let them maintain the ledger of where the money is, and that cost has already been removed.
That's a big,
so yeah, not if. Not a difference.
It's a big if that you used.
Yeah, but you'd be doing that with Bitcoin anyway, yeah. Right? You'd be trusting the relationship between the coin and the certificates. So the difference between the state having Bitcoin as its backing and just using an account of their own keeping is really a non-difference, right? Because you have to trust the issuance of the certificates that people are actually using.
Exactly.
So yeah, it doesn't. It's a complete non-distinction. Now, some people might argue that states want to have Bitcoin so they can spend it, or they can speculate on it, right? Speculate on its price change, and that may be very true. So we're not talking about backing a currency. We're just talking about states having some. But so what? I mean, states have some Bitcoin. Great. I mean, it doesn't change any of the financial system, right? It doesn't. Right. What matters to people is that people are using Bitcoin, right? So if you're using the state's money and the state happens to also hold Bitcoin, it's like using fiat and the state also happens to have gold. What good does it do you? It doesn't do you any good. Right.
Perfect. So segueing it to the next monetary policy, a state where Bitcoin is used lawfully, so there's no national currency, the only money used in the society is Bitcoin. Do you see that happening, or let's say, for the sake of the argument, a state would adopt that?
A state would allow it, you mean?
Yeah, allow it.
Because that scenario doesn't require that.
Only use Bitcoin in the for.
Well, no, I mean, basically, what you're saying is that the state accepts Bitcoin in the cancellation of its debts, and people use Bitcoin in the clearing of their accounts and all that. Well, that kind of amounts to So it's if everybody's using Bitcoin and they're using it for clearing their accounts, they're lending still, right? And still at the same rate. People's time preference controls their preference for money now versus money later. And people, you know, if there's no lending, there's no production. Right? All production requires time, and that means time without your money, whether you lend it to your own company or yourself, or you know, so that you can do production. But during that time, you don't have it. You're spending it to produce things. So all production requires time and money or capital, right? And that means there's lending, and people lend based on their time preference, not anything else, their desire for stuff now versus later. And that doesn't change with interest rates or anything like that. It changes based on whatever's in people's minds. People lend more, you know, when it's cheaper, when they can make more money, when interest rates change. But that doesn't, there's no implication there to their time preference. So this is a preference, like, you know, sexuality is a preference. I prefer this over that. So, time preference is what governs how much people are lending. I mean, for an individual, if I have more money, I might lend more. My time preference might be different. But interest rates, things the government's doing, whatever, those are not, you know, you can't say that those make any change at all. So
in a Bitcoin country, the interest rates would reach the interest rate naturally, right? Because it's...
Well, it does anyway. I mean, this is just another distortion that comes from the state. When I talk about the interest rate, I'm not talking about, say, the federal funds rate or the, you know, discount window rate or the bank rate. What's that?
People's interest rate, right?
It's called the economic interest rate, right? So the economic return on capital is fairly uniform around the world because of arbitrage, right? If I can make more here versus there, I go here and not there. As long as, you know, you don't have strong capital controls or restrictions like North Korea or something, right? It's probably a little different. But generally, the interest or the economic rate of return on capital is fairly consistent, and it's, you know, historically around 9.5%, say 10%, right? So this rate doesn't really change that much. I mean, it can, but we don't observe that. So that's a reflection of human time preference. And what you see in banks is different. You know, they're providing all kinds of services. They're subsidized. There's all these different reasons why the bank rates don't reflect that directly. But so that's the opportunity cost of not investing, right? You're losing 10% of, you could be making 10% of your capital over time, but if you don't, you lose that opportunity. So that's why people lend, and if they didn't lend, there'd be no products. So what I'm trying to get at is, in a Bitcoin universe, right, where everybody's using Bitcoin as the money, everybody on the planet just uses Bitcoin at the money, they're still lending, and they're still, therefore, credit expansion, and you still end up with the same amount of money and money substitutes. And that's a function of simply what everybody's individual reserve requirement is, and that tends to be, you know, a fairly consistent number as well on the average. So you can't do away with credit expansion, you can't do away with lending, you can't do away with the fact that people are considering these accounts as if they're money, right? Like in my Bitcoin bank, I've got this much money and it's been lent out to somebody else so they can make something so I can get interest, right? Great. So it all kind of looks the same. It's like electronic gold at that point, right? The problem here isn't with that. That's a great kind of vision for a free market. But if we had a free market in money, we wouldn't need Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is a defense against anti-market forces, right? The state. The state wants a cut, right? And it's a great way to make money if you can print it yourself. Okay. So why wouldn't
the state accept taking a cut in a Bitcoin universe?
Because they can't create more Bitcoin, so they can't take that cut.
So you're
right?
arguing...
When I say take a cut, I don't mean earn interest, right? I mean earn seigniorage, right? So they want their privilege cut, which is monopoly control over production of the money at a below market cost for producing the money, the inflation tax. So in a Bitcoin universe, there's no inflation tax. Or in a gold universe, there's no inflation tax either. People can go produce gold at the market cost of producing gold, right? And that's what keeps the prices in gold stable. Right, not non-volatile, but stable. They, you know, when the price of gold generally tends to rise, people are incented to go dig more up, and the supply increases, and it brings the price back down, which is what maintains price stability, which is good for a money. Bitcoin has the same behavior. People haven't understood it very well and don't really see it yet, but it does have the same stability property. So these two worlds look very similar. Mm-hmm. So what you observe in the gold world, you can imagine observing happening in the Bitcoin world, right? Eventually, the state wants to take that privilege cut. How do they do it? They pass some laws, right? So if people, just like with gold, they don't resist those laws, you know, you end up right with gold, where you did with gold. And so certainly people do resist, but they're called criminals, right? They buy and sell things with their gold, and they, you know, don't respect the laws. So if for example, the state wanted to take that cut in the Bitcoin universe, they just pass a law that says, well, Bitcoin is illegal in our world, right? But we've got this other, you know, we're going to make this change that everybody has to accept. And if you accept that, you know, you're using legitimate digital currency. And those there'd be two changes. State. One is a, yeah, I call it Fedcoin, right?
Fedcoin.
And this is probably an Americanism, but it's, you know, so Fedcoin is this idea that I, you know, I just, in order for me to be able to take my cut, I pass a law that says everybody, all people that are accepting Bitcoin have to accept this rule change, which is I can sign my own coin, right? I can create my own Coinbase.
Before going to Fedcoin. To Fedcoin, because that's the last monetary policy that I want to talk about. When Bitcoin is used lawfully, why do you think state doesn't want just to take its cut through taxes? Why do you think they want also the printing ability? Why?
Well,
is it that people don't want to give so much for taxes? They want more of a free market. What is it that why the state?
Well, tax by definition. Yeah, I get it. I mean, tax by definition is involuntary, right? Because if it was voluntary, it'd be called charity. So, you know, I just give some money to this organization and they provide security or whatever. Or if it was an exchange for something, which is more likely, right, it would be called a free market. So you have the free market where you could have charity or you could contribute or pay for services that you imagine the government providing, which we do for a lot of services, you know.
Right?
It doesn't have to be local, just whatever, right? So you can imagine these things being voluntary in the market, but the state is involuntary. So tax by definition is involuntary. It's a taking using aggression, right? So it's a theft. So if the state wanted to, it could certainly say we'll use gold or we'll use Bitcoin and we won't be able to tax via inflation, monetary inflation, but we'll just enforce other taxes and we'll get the same amount of money, right? Same cost to everybody. The cost is distributed differently for one, right? It's you know, when you inflate money, you're distributing the cost through all money holders, which tends to be, believe it or not, lower net worth people, right? Because it's only when you're holding the money or a money substitute where you pay that tax. And people with lower net worth tend to have very little savings, right? Actual money. Actual investments, which don't suffer the inflation tax. If you're holding currency or money, you're paying that tax. So as a portion of your net worth, if you're worth billions, you've got, you know, almost all of it invested. You have a tiny little portion to use for your day-to-day affairs. But if you're not so wealthy, you may not have anything invested, and all of what you have saved is in cash, right? It's in money. So that inflation tax is distributed potentially very differently, right? And that's one issue. If you want to tax one kind of group of people, say money holders, more than everybody else, you know, use inflation. Another issue is that, and I think this is also a very big issue, is that when you tax through the money via inflation, people don't see it. Like very few people understand it. Places where people understand it is where inflation gets very high. I've gone a lot of places in the world, and you go to a place like Zimbabwe, for example, they know how it works. Mm-hmm. You talk to Americans, and a lot of them just don't know how it works. Like, it's the tax? What do you mean?
They don't feel it.
They think it's just like the state tells them. It's a consequence of economic growth, or, you know, there's been a boom and bust, and it's caused some inflation. You know, it's just like all this metaphors, or the Fed is trying to control inflation, right? I mean, that's ridiculous, right? They create it.
Or they create wars where they say they need the money, right? So that
right. Well, it creates debt. The debt creates more need for tax, and the tax through the money creates inflation. So it's debt that causes inflation. The state wants the money, and they want a tax, but they don't want people to know they're taxing them. That would be, you know, unwise when you're the state. So what I'm getting at is that taxing through the money has, you asked me, like, why would they do that instead of just tax directly? It has the advantage of being opaque. Mm-hmm. People can't see it. Most people don't see it. They can see it, but they don't. So it has those two characteristics. One, it distributes the tax in a certain way, and two, it makes the tax less visible. So Bitcoin does have, the potential to allow people to avoid the tax, right? If they're using Bitcoin, they have it, they spend it, they save it, they receive it. All that money that they have their net worth in is not being taxed through inflation, just like if they were using gold. The advantage of Bitcoin over gold primarily is that you can move Bitcoin over a wire. You can't move gold over a wire.
What's
so
in your mind? Right. It's a couple of words.
Right. It's the portability of Bitcoin that is really the big distinction. And and in a modern economy, that's fairly important. Right. It's one of my theories on why gold is no longer illegal as a money in the U.S., right? They dropped that constraint. So it's okay. Why? Because you couldn't really do that much with it, right? Why have this issue? So now Bitcoin comes along as a way to restore that ability to have a money that avoids the inflation tax, but can also be pushed over a wire,
which helps the global economy, right?
Well, if people the way it helps the economy is by letting people keep more of their own money and by avoiding tax. But as you suggested, state can just come and tax in other ways. With greater visibility of the fact that they're being taxed, people might actually, vote or somehow make a change to wait. Yeah, they might actually make a political change, right? Like, let's not have all these taxes because we can see them now. I mean, there have been in the U.S., we're famous for tax revolts, right? tarring and feathering the tax man and running him out of town because the taxes got too high. Well, if you can't see the taxes, that's not going to happen.
So
right?
Do you think the 3% that is the target of inflation for many countries, is it like a level where people don't feel it, or is it a level where people don't try to resist it and
put yourself in the shoes of the tax man. When the taxes get too high, heads start rolling, literally. So there's an issue. Now maybe it's just don't want to lose my job type of thing, or I don't want to be have my head chopped off in the street, right? Those things happen. And at some point when the inflation gets too high, there's, like Venezuela right now, right? Taxes are high. And one of those taxes is, one big one is inflation, which is why the currency's become absolutely useless. But when people start getting upset, then the state resorts to currency controls, right? Prevent people from moving other currencies in and out of the country. Including official foreign exchange rates, right? Fixed exchange rates, which you can move your money, but you're going to pay a huge tax in doing it. So you end up with a lot of black market activity, you end up with a lot of civil unrest, and you end up with eventually blood in the streets. And we've seen that whole progression in recent times in Venezuela over the last 20 years. It's progressed to that point. So that's the consequence of taxes getting too high. The Fed setting, a target inflation rate. Yeah, that's a form of setting what your tax is. Even at 0% price inflation, where you have to make a distinction between price inflation and monetary inflation. Monetary inflation is just increasing the amount of units of the money. Price inflation is a consequence of that and other things, but persistent price inflation is a consequence of devaluing the money by creating more of it. So if you set a target of zero price inflation, right, what does that mean? That means that even though there's increasing demand for the money due to economic growth, the money's not buying anymore, right? So for example, every year technology gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, it's an exponential growth. Things get cheaper to produce over time because we're building with better tools. they take less time, less resources, and we have better processes. So things should be getting cheaper over time if they're not printing any money, right? Mm-hmm. So even a 0% inflation in the money would indicate there's been some mining going on, right?
Some money inflation.
Yeah, but that happens with gold too, right? So things become cheaper, which means the money's buying more, which means if you can go make some of the money, you can make a profit. So mining of the money increases and brings prices, you know, back down, but it also provides the money more cheaply for people, right? So it's just a market function. With the state, the production cost of the money is very low. So they can maintain 0% inflation, price inflation, still print a bunch of money at way below its cost, and then capture that difference in the printing cost from the market cost as a tax. So even at 0%, you're getting taxed.
Yeah.
So that target of 3%, you know, is on top of that. And you know, who knows, you know, the formulas they use for determining what's actually price inflation is also kind of fishy. But in the end, it's just look at it like a tax, and taxes get too high, people get upset, and the state gets in trouble, and so that's their restraint.
So on that note, means that in a Bitcoin universe, even if all wages stay the same, the prices should always go down, right? For all the
yeah, but there's a limit on that too. So if you have a deflationary currency, right, prices going down, which means you know that there's a fixed supply. The money can get very expensive for people, and this has happened, you know, at times. And certain types of economists tend to look at this as well. Deflationary money is bad, and the reason they say it's bad is because people are unwilling to reduce your salary. Right? Uh-huh. It's not just that the things you buy are going down in price; it's the money you're making is going down in price. Right? So that's a psychological thing that it's only because people have been trained to recognize that. Right? Oh yeah, instead of every year my wage goes up, every year my wage goes down, but I'm still buying the same amount, right? Why would it matter? Well, yeah, I mean, in theory, you should be able to deflationary money doesn't make everybody richer just because it's deflationary. That's not rational. Just like an inflationary money doesn't make everybody poorer just because it's inflationary. That's take for gold, for example, right? It's the tax that's the issue. The same amount of products have to be produced using the same amount of work and the same number of resources, whether the money is inflationary or deflationary. It's the tax that's added on top of it that makes inflationary money burdensome. But you know, there's this effect with the deflationary money that you know you have like gold. We call that a neutral money. Right? I mean, there's monetary expansion, but there's not price inflation over time. It stays fairly consistent, moves with the economy. Yes, but with fiat, because there's a tax, you have positive inflation, and with something that's fixed or declining supply, you can have negative inflation.
What I meant with the deflation in a deflationary currency, people, even if their wages go down, but because of the advancements in technology, the prices of the goods go even lower, and that's why even if they have lower wages, they still can buy more.
Well, you're making an assumption there that the price is going down. The money is deflationary. In other words,
but
prices are going down.
The money because of the technological advancements.
Right. But you said two things. You said not only is it going down because it's a deflationary currency, but it's also going down because of technology advancements. They're the same thing, right? The economy is expanding.
Okay, I get it.
Right?
Yeah, you're right.
And that's fighting for the same number of units. So what I mean, people are competing for the same number of units of the currency. So that implies that the currency is being is increasing in value in relation because the pie is getting bigger, right? Yeah. And that's technology and growth.
Right.
People offset that, right? People offset inflation with different interest rates, or not necessarily different interest rates, but discounting future money, right? And you can do the same thing with in a deflationary economy in the other direction, right? I'm not going to lend you money that's increasing in value at 5% without considering that, right?
Yeah.
But I will still get my money back when the loan is over, and I'll still get the full value of my money, and I'm still going to charge you the interest rate, which is based on my time preference, right? So it still works. If the deflation is high enough that I'm able to capture higher than the interest rate just by holding on to it, then I'll do that, right? But the idea that the economy is going to go faster than the interest rate doesn't really make a lot of sense either, right? And so there's this belief that Bitcoin is going to skyrocket forever, which is one, not a good money. It needs to have price stability to be a good money. That's one of the properties of money, right? It does have that built into it. We just haven't hit it yet, right? So when the cost of using Bitcoin becomes higher than the thing you're buying, you won't use it. This is an important principle that speaks to people's imagination of a Bitcoin economy. They imagine everybody sitting around doing nothing, just getting rich because they have Bitcoin. Right? That's ridiculous. People have to go out and produce things, lend their money, everything that they did before for there to be any more products and for wealth to increase. Right. So what happens with Bitcoin is as there's more demand for the money. This is unique about Bitcoin. It's unique in that it's a fixed unit money, but it's also unique in the fact that there's a fee associated with other people using it, right? Other people transacting, my cost of using it goes up. And so those are two kind of offsetting unique characteristics. As it gets more and more highly used, it becomes less useful. So it's not a deflationary money. Can't be. It'll stabilize. And as we get to that point, right, people imagine, layering like lightning, solving these problems. Those are things that can mitigate these problems. The more security trade-offs you're willing to make, the less cost you have in transacting. You can go to Coinbase and do all kinds of transactions. You're not paying the fees because it's not actually going on chain, but you've made a trade-off. And that happens no matter what you do, you're making that trade-off. So the fees push themselves up into the layers and you have the same limit. So people have to recognize that at some point, right, alternatives, for the money become cheaper and they use them. That's always the case.
The deflationary rate in the future, is it going to be sum of the technological advancements and the amount of Bitcoin that's still there for mining?
Well, I mean, if you're imagining a increase in purchasing power from nothing but having some Bitcoin, then where's the increase coming from? Right. Where is that? Where? What's causing that to happen?
In a Bitcoin world, right?
Where? Right. Imagine everybody has Bitcoin. Yeah. It's the only money we're using, and the Bitcoin gets more and more valuable every year. What is causing that?
Let's say devaluation of the products around in the economy because they're cheaper to make. So your money.
Okay. So another way of saying that there's more production. Right. More supply is what makes them cheaper. Right. I can supply them at the same, supply them more of them at the same cost. Yeah. More production is what we're calling technological or economic growth that comes from lending, producing, building on the previous tools that were produced and so on. Right. Right. So it comes from having more people produce more things. They have more, this is just a natural part of economy. You get absent, catastrophic or destructive events like wars where you destroy a huge amount of capital. But even that, in the long run, it's very small. Percentage-wise, it compounds to be a tremendous loss. But if you look at the pace of history, these things have happened, periodically, and everything keeps moving on. We continue to grow as a society in terms of our productivity and our capital. So that continues to happen. I mean, if everybody's only using one money, then the units of the money that are representing all this wealth. At least the monetary wealth, if they're not expanding, then each unit's going to have more purchasing power. So it's only that increase in production that's causing that. And that increase in, production, I don't like to use the word GDP, but right, the stuff that people are producing, that is fairly constant. I mean, it's, varies a lot from region to region, but over the, the globally, right, over time, we have this fairly steady, change. And that's what you would expect the money to do, right? It's just reflecting growth in production. So growth in wealth. But the money itself is not the source of the wealth. It's a way to avoid tax, right? And it may just shift the tax to another place. So people have imagined this because they've seen this monetization of Bitcoin, right? But if you monetize any commodity, right, people start using it as money, yeah, it will appreciate in value, which means you'll see price deflation. But with Bitcoin, there's a limit. And the same thing with gold. There's a limit. People start digging it up, and eventually these things level out. And with Bitcoin, transaction fees start rising, and that rise in usefulness hits a limit. So what I would expect when that happens is layering will extend that to some extent, but then the security guarantees as you get further and further away from the coin get weaker and weaker. So you hit the same limit. Fees, for example, you want to do a Lightning transaction, you have to make a pretty significant security trade-off. You're going to do a bunch of microtransactions, you still have to be able to settle on chain, right? Yeah. Settle the money on chain. Well, in order to do that, you have to put at least a fee at risk, right? So if the fees are getting to, because there's, you know, 5,000 transactions or so every 10 minutes that are going through the system globally, fees are going to be pretty high. Putting that much money at risk to do, you know, a few microtransactions or something is not rational. So you end up with either a trade-off in centralization, like a Coinbase-y thing, or maintaining channels with hubs. And I'm not assuming that Lightning is the only answer to these questions, but the fees matter in every context. So they have to get paid by the people who are doing the transacting. So you hit these limits, and then you wonder, well, geez, what's going to happen? The money, now we're just not going to end up using the money anymore. It's for most things. This is too expensive. But what happens when that happens with other monies? People move to substitutes, right? People move to what's a better money for their situation. So Bitcoin has this unique characteristic, which I think is, you know, people don't like to accept, but you know, you can create another one, right? Just, you don't even have to change the software. Just change the Genesis block, for example, and start over. Yeah, low hash power, low security. Bitcoin itself went through that, and maybe it only succeeded because, you know, nobody noticed. But you could imagine enough people all at the same time deciding they want to do this and putting enough security behind it that they can get it started and create another one. If there's enough demand, that will happen. So now you have a money that's got lower security. Exactly. It's got started already. Let's just start monetizing testnet coins. I used to use actual coins for my tests because it was a hassle switching to testnet. But you can imagine that, okay, well, because the cost of using this money is so high, we just start using another one, right? And that's not a free thing, right? People have to pay the fees to create the security and build the network, you know, so we build up another money. What's wrong with that, right? There's nothing wrong with that. It's like silver to gold. You do this thing, and then you do, you know, that one hits a limit too, and you end up with these electronic, this set of electronic monies that could be pretty much indistinguishable other than the fact they're on different chains. So Bitcoin has this, I mean, it's weird to think about it that way, but Bitcoin has this characteristic of allowing itself to create more units and keep the fees under control. And it's like, now I sound like a shitcoiner, but it's not reasonable now because fees are way too low, right?
Yeah.
And there's just not enough demand for the money. But when you get to the point where you're talking about this massive adoption, right, that seems inevitable.
The cost would be very high, right?
Right, right. Creating that, you know, yeah, that new money would become really valuable because you could not now do it. So it's just not valuable enough now. People, you know, according to Thier's law, and in the absence of currency controls, people use the better money. Well, the better money with the same fee level is the one with the much higher security and adoption, right?
Yes.
Acceptance. So people use Bitcoin, of course. But when you have that, when you get to that point where it's now economically rational to make the trade-off, then that's likely to happen. Otherwise, I don't, you know, it'll be fairly marginal. You won't be able to do that much volume over it. Now, what level that is, I don't know. I shouldn't say marginal, but there is a limit, I should say.
But do you think that it's only natural to go to a different, let's say, different electronic money, but always backed by Bitcoin? So like the Lightning Network, which is, it is actually like a second layer. We would only go to third layer, fourth layer.
Well, that's not backing. That's not really backing, right? Backing is when you take out a loan against you know, like you know, Federal Reserve notes, right? It's the notes are backed as a promise to pay in gold, right? If you have something that's cryptographically guaranteed, that's layering. So I use that term to make that distinction, right? You have a distinction between reserve currency, you know, where you have this relationship, and backing. I'm sorry, and layering. So yeah, layering makes sense. But again, both of those are similar trade-offs, right? So layering can improve up to a certain extent, and creating new coins can make a similar trade-off, right? Reduce security, but otherwise everything's the same. And now you have an exchange cost in both cases, right? The problem with layering as it currently exists is if fees are very high, it's not usable for a huge number of scenarios. It's still really just not usable for a scenario where the fee tends to kind of be anywhere, you know, proportional to the amount you're spending, right? Like getting close.
I can imagine in the future a bank opening one Lightning channel. With a high fee, but it's a trade-off, yes, of trust. But in the end, you would use.
Well, that's the point, right? That's the point. You're making the trust trade-off either way. So you can amortize a lot of transaction fee over the course of that channel being open, and you could maybe mitigate the risk of losing, having to close the channel quickly with a high fee, you know, that's maybe 1,000 times more than the amount you were going to spend by, you know, having the channel open with a trusted party. But again, we're going back to this idea of trust, large institutions, and that's what we're trying to avoid. So that is a real non-trivial trade-off. And you can make the same trade-off with a smaller coin, right? It's a smaller coin. It's got hash, it's got double spend risk because it doesn't have as much security, but it's a different type of trade-off, right? You're not making institutional transactions and promises, keeping channels open and taking those kind of risks. You can operate at smaller scale,
but you have and privately the effect, right? Like people would rather use the harder money even if they would have to give up to have some trade-offs. Don't you think it would
have some trade-off? So if I'm going to pay $1,000 fee to buy a Coke, it's not a very rational trade-off.
No, what I meant, using like a bank based on Lightning Network, you know, you would trust maybe rather that bank and using Lightning instead of using a different coin.
You might, right? But again, you might be doing black market transactions, and you're not going to trust the white market bank. Right now, you could have a big black market bank, but again, these institutions get big enough, and you're taking some serious risk, right? I mean, look at dark markets, for example. Right. This brings up another point that I kind of ignored in all the past discussions, which is Bitcoin is not a white market money, right? As we discussed before, state wants to come in and take their cut. They just turn it into Fed coin, and it's a different money.
Perfect. Wait 1 second. Segueing in the third monetary policy. That's where the final thought. The black market.
Yeah.
This is where you think it will naturally head, right? Bitcoin, because the state always wants.
Well, its security model offers no protection against laws. Right. You can't. It's permissionless. When we use this word, we're speaking metaphorically about. We can resist the state. We don't have to ask for permission to move our money across the border, transact in the middle of the night, you know, go buy some drugs or whatever. We can do this without permission. So you can't just kind of thumb your nose at the state and say they can't pass a law, right? Right. That's not part of the Bitcoin security model. The Bitcoin security model says if they do pass a law, if you want to take the risk, you can still use this money. That's what it means. So there's no security for white market use of Bitcoin. If you want to use it, and you think that you're going to continue to use it even after it's illegal, you are accepting the fact that you will be using it criminally.
Yeah.
And so the only security in the white market is political security. And people will argue, well, they can't pass a law. Well, maybe they won't, but they certainly can. Mm. And Bitcoin itself does nothing to stop that. That's up to the voters, and they didn't quite stop it the last, 1,000 times. So that's political security, and Bitcoin's not a political money. It doesn't help you, get more votes or anything like that. Yeah. It may be very popular, but that didn't stop the state from seizing gold either, yeah. The world's most popular money. So, you know, the Bitcoin is, its security model is designed to allow it to operate without permission, which means, you know, decentralization itself is not security. You could have every business in the world accepting Bitcoin, highly decentralized, right? Very evenly distributed. But one stroke of the pen, you know, from you know, various governments, wherever you are, that's within their territory, you're not, even though you are highly decentralized, you offer no resistance. So, just like with taxes, right? You know, businesses are highly distributed. It doesn't prevent them from having to pay tax. So this idea of decentralization is operation at small scale allows you to hide, right? And more people doing it spreads that risk around. So you're going to go kind of nab a bunch of people, and they're all operating at small scale. So black markets tend to take, you know, large scale business and turn it into a lot of little small scale business. The ones that are big, you know, maybe, you know, the drug cartel, you know, they're operating kind of, because they're big, they're operating with a huge amount of risk, and they tend to get busted. Yeah. So even if they even if they're operating with state protection, up to some extent. So, you know, but in the end, it can still happen. You can still operate, you know, illegally, you know, in the black market, in the free market, right, using Bitcoin. And then, you know, states tend to not like that. They can't suppress this thing, this money laundering or whatever. And so they go into enforcement mode, not just pass the law, but go and enforce it. And the easiest way to enforce in the black market your goals as a state against Bitcoin is to just set up the, you know, a massive mine and mine from one single point on the earth. Right, this most centralized miner is more efficient. So people say that can't be done. Well, that's absurd. Of course, it can be done. I mean, we went to the moon. You can certainly do it if they want to do it. The question is, how does Bitcoin defend against that? Right, and it has built in, even though I don't think Satoshi ever recognized it, you know, a defense against that, which is the fact that it's fee based. So transactions that the sensor is not are not taking have opportunity cost. Right, somebody's going to come along and grab those transaction fees that are rising because people's transactions are not getting confirmed. Right, white market transactions get confirmed, black market transactions don't. Those rise in fees, and since more hash power brings in more capital for mining, and eventually the miners capture those fees. So, if the black market fees have a high enough differential from the white market fees, you'll overpower the state unless the state wants to subsidize with tax revenues. Right, and then you're going to have to out the black market or the free market's going to have to outspend in terms of fee premiums what the state is tax subsidizing with tax in their mining operations.
But this is at the global level, right? Global.
This is at any level. I mean, it doesn't matter if one state does it. It doesn't matter, you know, if the black market exists only in one state. It doesn't matter if a bunch of states are part of the black market, you know, rogue states. It doesn't matter. So all that matters is that all that matters is that the people who are paying the fees to pay the miners to mine illegally are paying them enough to overpower the 51% attack. One person that's doing it from, you know, Omaha or something, yeah. Right? Because, you know, people aren't going to just donate their money to mining. They're going to have to get paid.
So do you think there are going to be like two societies where there's the state society and the black market society?
There are two societies. there's the free market, and then there's the white market, you know, or black market and the white market. You know, these things seem to be, you know, it's a clear concept, right? There's people who obey the law and there's people who don't, right? But maybe the law is kind of ambiguous, so it's not perfect, but there's a clear concept there. And it exists. It's very big, right? The black market is massive. And it having its own money that works and can send it around and not be monitored, which is a big criteria in the black market, and not be taxed through inflation, because it's kind of hard to find big banks to store your money. You know, so if you're storing them in dollars, you're gonna, you know, as opposed to having them invested, you're gonna pay that tax.
Yeah, but then so you don't have to store. You can store them yourself. So
you can store it yourself, right? It's a disadvantage in that there's an opportunity cost in storing money, right? If you don't have it invested, but presumably everybody in the black market is doing business. That's why it's black market. So they're investing their money, they're spending it, they're using it, they're lending it, and so you know, this, but it has to be able to be done at small scale, mm-hmm. right? So mining and merchanting have to, those are two things you do with Bitcoin, right? Holding it doesn't take anything at all. It's not an action. It doesn't resist the state. It's equivalent in the security model to lost coins, right? Yeah. It just doesn't matter. But once you start accepting it in trade for something, or once you start mining it, which is another way of accepting it, right?
Yeah.
You accept the fees and you're basically trading, you know, power consumption for fees. You know, these things that you do that accepting Bitcoin are the things that are going to have to hide. And those are the things that require full nodes, right? And mining power. And those have to be doable at small scale. And that's really the essence of this, you know, idea of keeping it possible to operate at small scale. But it's not just small scale that helps you with anonymity. It's privacy features of the coin itself and anonymity of the coin. You can't have identity, right? These ideas of like creating, you know, peer-to-peer network changes, you know, which introduce basically node identity, right? We'll create essentially a key pair, right? And I'll give you my private key and you can identify that my node. Well, that doesn't mean anything to you unless you know who I am, right? So that's your private identifier for me. And so we all start setting up identity associated with these nodes and we know who each other are,
okay.
right? And so this is not a good idea in Bitcoin. The data on the network is public, right? That's the whole point. This is public data. We don't use encryption and identity like banks do to ensure that people aren't stealing. We use validation, right? we have the ability to know the data is good or not good just by looking at public data and running an algorithm, right?
Now, the costs.
What's that?
Voluntarily, so everybody can do it without a
cost. Right, we can all do it. So we don't need to secure all these channels between each other and know who each other are. We don't want to. We want to be anonymous to each other, right? So there's always a problem of introducing a new transaction to the chain, right? But that's technologically that's what you want to use an anonymizing network for, like Tor, you know, I2P. You take your transaction, you post it to a public server that everybody else is, you know, posting to, which itself is, you know, anonymous, and it doesn't matter who runs it, right? As long as your transactions get onto the network, right. And nobody knows who posted it. But once all that data is in the network, it's all public data. It's completely public. The transaction, you know, pool, the blockchain, you know, communication between nodes is still public data. So anyway, Bitcoin has this ability through these types of privacy, anonymity, and small scale features to allow people to operate hidden. And that's a central aspect. It's the first aspect of the security model.
Wouldn't you say that in the black market economy, that economy is more efficient, which means that in a long enough run, the black market or free market economy would outpace the state economy?
Well, that's where this, again, we go back to the value proposition of Bitcoin, reducing your tax, right? So if you can reduce the tax for the people who can still do it, who are the people who are willing to take the risk, yeah, you know, the free market then becomes more efficient. So yeah, it's an incentive actually to join the free market, avoid paying some tax, right? But you know, I'm not advocating for one or the other. I'm not making value judgments about what's good and what's bad. I mean, I only have one principle that defines morality, good, bad, and that's non-aggression. So by the non-aggression principle, you know, tax is bad, state bad, but I would never encourage people or tell them they're a bad person because they're not willing to you know, throw themselves on the, what do you call it?
The state.
Something like that. I couldn't find the right, couldn't remember the right metaphor. My memory's not always so good. But yeah, you know, it sacrificed themselves, right? These are personal choices that people make. But there's quite a few people who I've seen people say this, like, you know, if it became illegal, I just wouldn't do it. I don't want to be, you know, a criminal. Even though I understand that maybe it's perfectly my right, as a human being to interact voluntarily with other people, I'm not going to take the risk.
There's a tipping point, right? Like the inflation, the 3%, nobody has any problem paying it.
No, but I have a problem with paying it.
Yeah, of course.
I avoid cash as much as I can.
Many people, yeah, don't have a problem. Of course, there are some that do, but there's, because that's a small,
I understand.
Small percentage. There's one point at where the people would resist, you know, and maybe it's the same with taxing by the state in a dual society, you know. Maybe people, even if they find it illegal, maybe they will join the free market, you know, because they went over the tipping point.
Yeah, I mean, these are all economic decisions, right? I have risk, I have, you know, return. If all of a sudden you're living in Venezuela and your family's starving and can't get the medications you need, now the formula's different, right? And the money becomes more valuable to you. And you know, the risk has gone up, but the value's gone up as well. So you may do it, you know, and it, you know, again, everybody makes their own decision on whether they want to obey,
and what do you think,
and under what circumstances.
What do you think the state would do in a dual society? What money would they use? They use the same old fiat and try to compete, or how can they survive
compete in
an environment full of free market?
Well, the state does. It doesn't compete with the free market. It taxes the free market, and it turns it. You know, it taxes the market, and the people who avoid that tax are the people who are, you know, living in a somewhat freer market, right? Yeah. So what would the state do in a world where the black market uses Bitcoin? I mean, they're already doing it, right? It's they're going to make efforts as it becomes more impactful. I think I'd say they will. I'd say they can, and they might have more incentive to spend time and resources on suppressing use of Bitcoin in the black market once they've already done so in the white market. But the low hanging fruit is to just make sure that they have control over the money so they can tax through the money, and that will likely, I mean, if it becomes worth it to them when there's enough of an impact, that'll hit the large institutional, regulated, public, you know, all those companies will get hit first. I mean, just this should be really obvious, right? All this hubbub about Facebook recently. You know, they're one of the largest companies in the world, and they announced that they're going to, you know, do this thing, which is nothing like Bitcoin, but they're going to do this thing, and that matters all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So it's that impact that gets people going. And when we start having that kind of impact, the institutional, the largest companies are the low-hanging fruit, right? Yeah. And then you just work your way down the line until you've kind of made, you know, you've made this blanket change that says if you're confirming transactions that have not been authorized by the state, we haven't signed them yet, then you're a money launderer. Okay.
Yeah.
So that impacts mining. It's censorship. And the reason for censorship is so you can see what's going on. You can require identity and reasons, like they ask you at the bank if you take out too much money or put too much in, you know, where to come from, what are you going to do with it? Well, they can do that with every transaction once they have the authority to sign every transaction that gets confirmed. So there's a, you know, there's an easy law to pass. Yeah, you can't confirm any transactions unless we've signed them. Otherwise, you're a money launderer. Ooh, doesn't even seem that onerous, right? Bitcoin still works fine, right? Yeah. But then you've got, you know, also the desire to have the ability to print your own. If it starts becoming very valuable and widely used, I want to be able to print my own Bitcoin, right? So you force everybody to accept one other rule, which is, you know, if this key signs a coin, it's considered new money by the notes,
yeah,
right? Inflation, very easy to do technically, trivial.
Yeah, but of course that won't happen on the black market. That will never.
It may or may not. I mean, maybe black marketeers will use Fedcoin. Who knows, right? They use dollar, and dollar's inflationary.
Yeah.
Because it's more convenient than using gold sometimes, right? So again, these things aren't always that clear.
But it's obvious that the advantages of Bitcoin are tremendous over gold in a black market society, black market economy.
In a network economy. Gold is
even more. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So in a network economy, when you're moving stuff across borders, oh my God, you know, it's obviously quite a bit easier, right? Instead of trucking truckloads of cash, or you know, fiat or gold. So yeah, there's big advantages in a network economy with Bitcoin. there's risks of course. You know, there's not a lot of privacy in the transactions. So there's those
risks.
We can
mitigate those. So
I think we can improve that.
Yeah,
I think. I mean, sure. I think we can make that aspect of Bitcoin, if nothing else, quite a bit better.
Yeah.
I have faith. I can't say I can prove, but I have faith that smart guys are doing good work in delinking transactions, right? And eventually we'll get to that point.
Yeah. But what the big issue would be in the future is who mines the, who confirms the transactions that, like you said,
who confirms them and who accepts them?
Who? Yeah.
Right.
Accepting the black market, most definitely everybody will accept them, right?
Well,
the
mining is just a form of acceptance, right? It's just you're running a mine instead of running a shoe store, right? So it is kind of the same idea. People are buying Bitcoin for energy, which is just capital. Or people are buying Bitcoin for shoes or drugs or whatever. And so people that are accepting Bitcoin have to operate, right? They have to have some presence somewhere. They're not just owning some in their mind, and those are the people that provide security by resisting, by doing it.
So do you think that the free market economy is going to be impacted by the, it will have an impact from the fees of the of Bitcoin?
Absolutely,
because
right, anything
they will have
fees,
they will have
impact
fees.
Yeah, if it's used by, you know, say some estimates say the world's black market economy varies by how big the free market is, how big the white market is, right? So if the white market's 80%, because, you know, most people are comfortable with operating out in the open and, you know, they're happier in just accepting what's legal, then you have a bigger white market. In places that are much more oppressive, say North Korea, pretty much the whole economy is black market. Right, people wouldn't be able to survive if there wasn't black market activity. So, you know, you can have these places where you can imagine there's a lot of black market, like 20% of the world's economy, 25, 30, somewhere in there.
Yes.
And it doesn't get measured. You know, it's hard to estimate. But just take that as a number. That's a huge amount of money. That's a huge amount of transacting. That's a huge amount of fees. Right, if everybody in the black market just uses Bitcoin. Which there's really, I think, two ways that gets mitigated. One is through layering, which has a temporary, partial mitigating effect on one coin, but it hits a limit. But you always have the option, once it becomes valuable enough, to create, you know, essentially an identical coin. And, you know, maybe you make a trivial change to the mining algorithm and you make a change to the Coinbase and start over.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you've got another one. And there's no limit to how much of that you can do, right?
Yeah.
And people scream, "Well, that's inflation." I'm like, "Well, that's inevitable, right?"
But
it doesn't matter whether it's inflation or not.
But this is only because of the shortcomings that we have today in Bitcoin. So maybe with layering,
won't
have them, right, in the future.
No, as I said, layering has to pay the fees, right? Somebody has to pay the fees to be able to get on the chain. Otherwise, you're completely decoupled.
But what
from
if
the
black
coin
market becomes a big miner? You know, like many, many, many small miners, they pay for their... So the cost of mining is included in the price on the black market. I don't know if you...
I didn't follow that. Could you try that another way?
So the problem with the fees is that somebody has to pay for the expenses that the miners have. But if the black market becomes a big miner in itself, you know, maybe because they have to pay for those from the mining cost, they would have the prices
the
cost of the mining.
It's not. I mean, I'm not sure I'm following your scenario, but it's not just the need to pay for the mining cost. These are kind of codependent needs, right? One, there's a need to determine whose transaction should get confirmed first, right? Or can I never get my transaction confirmed because I have the same fee as everybody else, right? That's a problem with an inflation only coin, for example. There's no way to prioritize.
Yeah.
So the other problem with inflation only coin, for example, is you have no way to resist censorship because you have no way to pay the miners anonymously for mining the black market transactions, right? So the censors, the white market miners and the black market miners, there's no distinction, right? They're just white market miners. Why would they take the risk of mining illegal transactions if they're not getting paid more to take the risk?
Yeah.
So they go out of business because they're they have higher costs. They have to hide and operate at small scale and all that. So there has to be a premium, which has to come through higher fees than white market fees. So Bitcoin has to be fee-based, one. Yeah. So I've written these, I call it crypto dynamic principles, the three principles. Bitcoin has to be able to operate in a risk environment, right? People have to be able to hide. So it has to be anonymous, private, small scale. And people have to be willing to take the risk. If they're willing to do that, the second principle is it has to be, confirmation ordering has to be based on external input of something, which means always reduces to energy. It can't be based on the proof of stake. Because once somebody just buys up enough stake, they control the future of the coin, which means the history, which means they it's not censorship. Once the censor gets control, you cannot get them out. Yeah. With work being introduced, in other words, information outside the chain being introduced, you can always add more. So the market can always add more capital to push the censor out. And the third principle is, where does the capital come from? It comes from people being willing to pay more to black market miners through fees. Increment over the going white market fee rate for black market, in black market fees is the incentive for people to mine black market transactions, right? And the state has to offset that they have to offset the loss of getting less reward with taxes in order to keep their hash rate up. So that battle between, raising taxes, other taxes, right? Raising taxes somewhere, and the value, the additional value for transacting the black market is the interplay that you can't predict, right? Who's going to pay more?
Yeah.
But those fees are necessary, if only to provide that basic security that makes it work in the first place. It's not just so that miners can get, some compensation.
Yeah.
Of course, they have to get compensation or they wouldn't do it, but it has to be fee-based and it has to be energy-based.
Perfect. Eric, this was awesome.
Good questions.
You liked it as well. And
yeah.
I'm positive, even if I like to talk about these things, because I think Bitcoin is anti-fragile and we have to think about these things. And we have to work on solutions in improving the anonymity and maybe also decentralization of mining. But it was a pleasure, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.